lots and lots of ways. It kind of informs the conversation in terms of what we're reading and what's being published. And it kind of assigns more value to those things that sell large numbers and are commercially viable, and assigns, therefore, less value to things that are not so commercially successful, but may be really great works. It also limits the conversation to the point of sale, you know, when you're purchasing the work, rather than talking about other things like, you know, fan communities or the review community or the tertiary community where people read and study books or any number of other ways that we engage with books and writing. It sort of reduces the whole thing down to that point of sale and then assigns value based on that moment.
Now, a question following from that would be, how do they actually determine what's going to sell well?
Oh, that's the $25 million question. There's actually, there's not a lot of understanding in publishing business about what will be a bestseller. So what they tend to do is they follow trends. So, for example, we saw after the Twilight phenomena, we saw a huge number of vampire-related teen books get published because publishers were hoping that the flow and effect of the success of Twilight would be people will buy more books about vampires. And I was in a bookshop at one point, and a woman came in and said, have you ever got any other books like Twilight with vampires and romance? So they were right in a way, that does happen. And we saw then in every single bookstore around the globe, a paranormal bookshelf popped up. So suddenly there's an entire shelf that's dedicated to that stuff. So that, again, sort of leads what we read and leads what we're talking about, but it neglects stuff that is not trend, stuff that is long-lasting or stuff that is smaller in terms of the amount of noise it makes.
And now, in terms of looking at it from a modern perspective, do you think that we're less likely now than ever to have these kind of books that are, as you say, you know, good books, good novels, culturally valuable in some way, but not likely to be bestsellers? Do you think we're less likely to see those published nowadays than we would have in the past?
Yeah, I think that it is true that it's now more difficult for people who are writing less commercial works. And when we talk about, you know, commercial works, there's different kinds of commercial. There are commercial works that are enduringly popular, like books on cricket, books on cooking, those and gardening. Those things are enduringly popular. And then there are commercial books that are really about a current trend, like with the vampires and then the angels. And then at the moment, we've got the teen dystopia thing. So books that don't fit into those categories do struggle to find a publisher. And there's been research done that shows that what used to be called the mid-list, sort of books that would sell a little bit, were worth publishing in terms of the amount of money they made, but were not huge profit spinners for publishers. The mid-list has just disappeared. It's just not there anymore. So now they're sort of targeting most publishers. Of course, there are exceptions, are targeting things that they think will be really big first, and then they'll publish other things as sort of a second.
Right. And if you're just joining me, I'm talking to Dr. Dallas Baker about the publishing industry. And self-publishing continues to grow, with self-published books representing 31% of ebook sales on Amazon's Kindle store. What do you believe that self-publishing and the rise of this electronic reading and availability is cultivating culture, cultivating those books that wouldn't otherwise see print?
Yeah, that's obvious. I think the idea that self-publishing is posing a major challenge to traditional or commercial publishing is not particularly accurate anymore. At first, mainstream publishers were really sort of shocked by what was happening with self-publishing, but now they've sort of worked out that they can use it to their own advantage. That's what multinational corporations do. Any challenge to them, they then adapt and absorb. So what they're doing now is they're mining self-publishing for ideas. So they'll have a look at what's doing well by self-published writers, and they'll maybe offer some of those people contracts. But what mostly they do is they will then ask writers who are already on their books to do books like the ones that are doing well in the self-publishing field. But aside from that, self-publishing has created not just books, but a community. There's a whole cultural conversation around books by people who self-publish, write to publish, people who edit who don't write but edit self-published work, physical design covers. So there's these communities growing out of all books, but particularly strong in terms of self-publishing communities. They have developed a kind of an identity as independent authors. They talk to each other, they blog, they network, they're on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. So there's a whole lot of cultural activity going on around self-published work. But the same is true for traditionally published works. We have festivals and writers' events and speeches and interviews and all that sort of stuff sort of happening. We no longer engage with the book just in terms of the book. We now do it in terms of online media and TV, and we go along to festivals and stuff like that. So it is a huge cultural conversation. And my sort of whole argument about it shifts the conversation away from that point of sale to these more cultural stuff, because that stuff, you know, how we engage with a work, it says a lot more about who we are as a people than about how much we spent on the thing.